You're listening to Pistola Endocrine Podcast with your host, Dr. Joel Stillman.
Hello and welcome to the Pistola Podcast. In this episode, we're fortunate to have an expert in hypoglycemia who's going to walk us through some of the broad topics that we might encounter in hypoglycemia, including hyperinsulinism, ketotic hypoglycemia, and dumping syndrome. Joining us today is Dr. Paul Thornton, who is one of my colleagues here at Cook Children's Medical Center. Dr. Thornton has been in practice for 40 years and is a national as well as internationally known expert in hypoglycemia. Thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Dr. Stillman, thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure and an honor to speak with you today, and I look forward to talking about some of the important aspects of hypoglycemia, specifically talking about some of the latest developments in hyperinsulinism, talking a little bit about some new things in ketotic hypoglycemia, and finally wrapping up with maybe a little bit of discussion about dumping syndrome-induced hypoglycemia. So I'm ready to go when you are.
That's great. I'm very happy because, I mean, I tell you, hypoglycemia is definitely a part of endocrinology. And I think even for those of us that have been in the field and have been working, you know, and seeing patients, hypoglycemia can be very daunting. And certainly, you know, for us here at Cook Children's Medical Center, where you've established the Hyperinsulinism Center, we have probably some very, very challenging cases that really, you know, require a lot of a multidisciplinary approach in order to try to sort it out. So with that, I guess let's start the discussion and talk a little bit about hyperinsulinism and help us to understand the importance of working through the algorithm efficiently, because it is such a very complicated area where people can get, you know, caught in dead ends and have other challenges.
Well, Dr. Stillman, you raise a great point here, and that is the importance of getting through the diagnostic process quickly, because, you know, as we all know, hypoglycemia can cause brain damage, but specifically hypoglycemia associated with hyperinsulinism is really dangerous, because not only are the children and neonates deficient in glucose, but they also have none of the counter-regulatory fuels. Mm. So it becomes very important knowing that 20 to 40% of these children could end up having hypoglycemic brain damage, that we very quickly identify that the patient is hypoglycemia. And following the PES guidelines, we maintain the blood sugar greater than 70, and then working our way through the algorithm. So let's talk about the algorithm for a moment.
Okay.
So bearing in mind that we know that we need to keep the blood sugar above 70 at all times, this typically means that patients will be found to have hypoglycemia. They may be diagnosed because they had some risk factors, or they may be diagnosed because they had symptomatic hypoglycemia in the well baby nursery. And the importance is to immediately get that blood sugar up into the range of blood sugar that's out of the danger zone. So initially, we would recommend getting the blood sugar rapidly above 50 milligrams per deciliter. But if glucose levels continue to fall and intravenous glucose has to be used, now you want to target a blood sugar of 70 to keep the blood sugar above that area, that range. Mm-hmm. So initially, that would be using intravenous glucose, with boluses followed by infusions and rapidly increasing the rate. But the key thing now is, having diagnosed hypoglycemia, is to determine the etiology. And that means that we need to do a critical blood sample where we look at all of the different intermediary metabolites, particularly the hormone levels such as insulin, cortisol, and growth hormone, but also things like beta-hydroxybutyrate and lactic acid. And looking at these intermediary metabolites very quickly gets us into a diagnostic algorithm that says, here's a baby with hypoglycemia with a high glucose infusion requirement to keep the blood sugar above 70 and, you know, measurable insulin levels. So typically we would say it'll take 1 to 2 days to stabilize the baby get them under good control and determine that they need a critical evaluation. This should be done sometime after 48 hours of life. And typically one would have results to suggest hyperinsulinism in 3 to 5 days after that. So now you're talking about a baby of 5 to 7 days of life with ongoing glucose infusion requirements. Mm-hmm. And this is where we need to make the decision about diazoxide therapy or not. And as you know, diazoxide dosing can range from 5 to 15 milligrams per kilo per day. It's usually given in 2 divided doses. And our recommendation is to start at 10 to 15 milligrams per kilo per day if you believe this to be genetic hyperinsulinism, and mm-hmm. start lower, around 5 if you believe this to be a perinatal stress hyperinsulinism.
You bring up a good point there. So a couple of things. I mean, so obviously, you know, hypoglycemia, most of the hypoglycemia that we certainly see as endocrinologists is in, you know, the newborn or infancy time window. Would that be your experience as well? So, yeah. And, you know, and go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
Yes, typically we would see babies with hypoglycemia. So the most common time to present is in the newborn period, with the vast majority of hypoglycemic disorders presenting in the newborn period. But some present later on in life. But what, you know, we have to remember is that we see the worst cases who've already been diagnosed with hyperinsulinism. And out right. there is, you know, 25 to 30% of the normal baby population are going to have blood sugars that go down below 50 milligrams per deciliter in the first 24 hours of life. So really the tough job is for the neonatologist to recognize which one of these babies is a baby who is having a normal physiological change in blood glucose levels and which one is a baby with a serious underlying disorder. And typically, if a baby with hypoglycemia requires intravenous dextrose, that very quickly alerts you to the fact that this is something more serious than normal mm-hmm. transitional hypoglycemia. And this is why one then needs to get those blood sugars up above 70 milligrams per deciliter and proceed down the algorithm efficiently and in a time-wise manner.
So the hyperinsulinism clue, so obviously, you know, you mentioned about diazoxide. So diazoxide would be the first line as far as targeted treatment for hyperinsulinism. What would you say are maybe one or two things that are going to, besides high dextrose requirement, that might alert an endocrinologist or a neonatologist that, yes, this is hyperinsulinism?
I think the key thing here is that these babies are more likely than not to have symptomatic hypoglycemia and to not respond to simple interventions like oral glucose gel or feeding, and they're always going to require intravenous glucose, and they're usually going to require multiple boluses of 2 mL per kilo of D10 to get that blood sugar up. So very quickly, you're going to see the difference between a baby who's just a little bit at risk of hypoglycemia, is having a difficult transition, but very quickly they settle down and get better, whereas these babies very quickly will declare themselves to have a high glucose infusion rate.
Hmm. And what about labs? Because there are certainly some pitfalls on labs that we can see as far as making a definitive diagnosis and knowing that you're dealing with hyperinsulinism. Are there any pearls that you would share as far as getting accurate lab sampling so that we can make the diagnosis of hyperinsulinism?
You raise a very good point. And the key point here is that the lab work is best done after 2 days of age, because almost all babies with hypoglycemia undergoing the transition will have a critical sample that looks like hyperinsulinism, but doesn't necessarily mean it is. Mm-hmm. So pitfall number one is doing the blood work a little too early. So the goal is to stabilize the blood sugar. If the glucose levels are still unstable by 48 hours of life or requiring intravenous glucose to control them and make them stable, then the workup should be done. And then the second big pitfall is the interpretation of the lab work. So one of the sad things is that pathology departments will often put in normative values for things such as insulin or beta-hydroxybutyrate or lactic acid, but they don't know the circumstances under which the samples were drawn. So a normal insulin level in a lab is what they would call a fasting insulin level, and that could be anywhere from 2 to 18 milli international units per ml, but at a time of hypoglycemia, there should be no insulin. So one of the biggest pitfalls that I see, and this really comes down on the neonatologist rather than the endocrinologist, because we're all used to dynamic interpretation of tests, but the biggest pitfall is that the computer says that the insulin level of 5 is normal, but yet the blood glucose was 35 milligrams per deciliter at the time. And so someone ignores that and says, well, it couldn't be hyperinsulinism because the labs are normal.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. What about the glucagon challenge? That's a tool that we use here, and I know that I've had other endocrinologists talk to me about it as well.
Yes, the glucagon challenge is a great tool to get a quick idea of whether the liver is able to release glucose by breaking down glycogen in response to glucagon. And the only circumstances in which this can happen are in hyperinsulinism states, when insulin is preventing the normal physiological breakdown of glycogen during the development of hypoglycemia. And the second time that this can occur is when there is a deficiency in the counter-regulatory hormones to insulin. So you have a relative hyperinsulinism state. So in fact, giving glucagon to a baby who's hypoglycemic is a very good both therapeutic move because it will raise the blood sugar up above 70, but also diagnostic because it indicates that this patient had glycogen in their liver at a time of hypoglycemia. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about was the importance of genetic testing.
Right. So obviously, you know, if we've established hyperinsulinism, there can be a number of causes for hyperinsulinism. So definitely the timing of genetic testing is important. So please tell us more about that.
So what makes genetic testing so important in hyperinsulinism is that this is one of the few times a genetic test directly affects your management. And by this, what I mean is that we can do genetic testing looking for mutations in ABCC8 and KCNJ11, the two forms of hyperinsulinism that are typically unresponsive to diazoxide. And if we find two mutations in the patient, one from each parent, it tells us that the patient must have diffuse disease. Whereas if we find a single mutation in either ABCC8 or KCNJ11, and we know the parent of origin to be from the dad, or we don't even know the parent of origin at all, we have now got a 90 to 95% likelihood that this patient has focal disease. And this gets us to a whole new point, which is that there are only several places in the country who can do 18F DOPA PET scans to localize where the focal lesion is. And so this genetic testing becomes a critical part of the diagnostic algorithm. And what we all need to understand here is that with genetic testing, you get what you pay for. So for example, if you take some of the more lower cost tests, you get a great result, but it takes you 28 days. And that's 28 days the patient is sitting in your institution waiting to be transferred out if needed. Whereas if you do a rapid turnaround test in 4 to 7 days, then that affects your ability to make decisions. And so genetic testing is a very important part of the diagnostic algorithm and should be offered to children who have diazoxide-resistant hyperinsulinism. And so typically you know that by 10 to 14 days of life. So what we would generally recommend is that you find a baby with hypoglycemia, you confirm they have persistent hypoglycemia, you determine the cause to be hyperinsulinism, you treat with diazoxide, and by day 14 of life, you should know if this patient is diazoxide responsive or not. And that's the key time where you then consider, do I need to refer this baby to a center of excellence where they can do PET scanning and the genetic testing needs to be done at this time?
I see. One question I have for you regarding diazoxide responsiveness. How do, and this is a personal pitfall that I recall from a while back, how does one determine whether or not, truly know whether a baby is diazoxide responsive or not? I mean, we can obviously push the dose up. And of course, as you know, there are side effects the higher that you get. But how do we know yes or no this was a successful therapy?
So you're right, it can be tricky. I hate to say it, but it's a little bit like pornography. You know it when you see it. In other words, you know, we've all seen babies
yes.
that start on diazoxide and immediately within 3 days, blood sugars go up. You're able to rapidly wean on the diazoxide and clearly this baby is diazoxide responsive. On the other hand, you know, when babies have mutations in the KATP channel and you give them diazoxide, you know, the definition of diazoxide is not whether you drop the glucose infusion rate from a rate of 23 milligrams per kilo per minute down to 19 milligrams per kilo per minute, because that's not going to get the baby home. Mm. So in my mind, I would think about diazoxide responsiveness as a degree of response to the treatment that allows you to get the baby off intravenous fluids, to have the baby fed on a normal pattern, and to be able to go home knowing that if they miss a meal, their blood sugars are going to be stable. So it's not really a GIR number or a percentage change in the GIR. It's, can you get that baby home on a normal pattern of feeding? And if you can't, then they're not diazoxide responsive. Now, this is where the subtleties come in. Are they partially responsive? And so that's where you have the question, this patient was not able to wean off IV fluid. Do I need to continue the diazoxide and add another therapy? Or do I need to stop the diazoxide because the rate of complications are so great that unless I'm getting really good benefit from the diazoxide, then I don't need to stay on it. And in that case, I would say that if you're able to reduce the glucose infusion rate by 50% and still keep the blood sugar above 70, but not more than that, that would be what I would define as like a partial diazoxide responsive child. And in that case, I would leave the diazoxide, but add a new therapy in. Whereas if the glucose infusion rate really didn't fall, then you're as well off to stop the diazoxide and avoid the possible complications.
I see. Now, and obviously for our institution, the majority of the patients that are referred in are diazoxide non-responsive. You had mentioned about fluorodopa PET scanning. So tell us a little bit in the final segments on this part, a little bit about the process of the scanning, how that helps, and a little bit about just the whole comprehensive team approach that you all use as far as approaching suspected focal lesions.
Yes, well, that the use of the 18-fluorodopa is really the key to the next steps in the care of patients with hyperinsulinism. And so 18-fluorodopa is a non-FDA-approved imaging agent that we inject into the patients. It's taken up by many tissues of the body, but specifically it's taken up by the pancreas, and it is able to highlight the beta cells, not on an individual basis, but as a typical rule, what one sees when one does an 18-fluorodopa PET scan in a normal patient is that the head of the pancreas has more beta cells, so it tends to light up a little bit more than the remainder of the pancreas. In someone with diffuse disease, the whole pancreas lights up a lot more than in a normal pancreas because those patients are secreting so much insulin. And in a patient with focal disease, you tend to find one area of the pancreas that lights up a lot more than the remainder of the pancreas. Mm-hmm. And that's the clue to the surgeon to look at that part of the pancreas at the operation to find the focal lesion. And so you're right, this requires a multidisciplinary team. And here at Cook Children's, our hyperinsulinism center has been up and running for 10 years this year. So this is our 10th year anniversary. And altogether, we've seen over 300 patients, and we've performed over 60 PET scans. And in almost half of those patients, we found focal lesions. And by having a combination of a very experienced surgeon who's able to find the focal lesion with the aid of the PET scan, the pathology team who are able to recognize the focal lesion on the frozen section and tell us when we've got the whole lesion out, we've been able to cure over 90% of our patients with a limited pancreatectomy. And so, you know, doing the genetic testing to indicate that this is a patient who's a candidate for a PET scan, then doing the PET scan and having the multidisciplinary team approach has really enabled us to shorten our length of stays and improve our outcomes since introducing this new technology.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's a very complicated process that requires, you know, care and evaluation on each step. And appreciate, I mean, this is just a flyover view, but I think you've given us some very important pearls in that area. I did want to ask you, before we segue to the next topic, if you had any other practical advice or insights that you would offer our audience on congenital hyperinsulinism.
I think the key point is to understand that not all patients are the same, that there are going to be variations, that the guidelines that are produced deal with the perfect world, and that there are always going to be little twists and turns, and that the key thing with these patients is to communicate with the families, to explain to them what you're doing, why you're keeping the blood sugar above 70, why it's important to maintain oral feeding so that when the baby is ready for home, they're able to eat and go home. There are so many little nuances to the care that really these are the things that you pick up as you see more and more children. And, you know, one of the things that I always say is, if you're struggling, if you're having problems, give us a call. Not all babies need to come to Cook Children's or to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, but we can help manage those babies and guide you through which ones need to be transferred out and which ones you can safely manage back in your own center. So don't ever hesitate to call us. We're always around for advice.
Well, very good. We're going to take a brief break here, and when we return, we're going to have Dr. Thornton discuss ketotic hypoglycemia, which is a very kind of nebulous diagnosis where you have hypoglycemia in ketones. While common, as Dr. Thornton's going to illuminate, there are a number of different causes and nuances in the condition.
You're listening to Pastola Endocrine Podcast. Pastola, pediatric endocrinologist of Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Arkansas. For more information about Pastola, please visit pastola.org.
Ketotic hypoglycemia is one of those conditions that on the surface looks like the easiest thing in the world to deal with, because we all know kids come into the emergency room and they have low blood sugars and high ketones, and as a general rule, they turn out to be fine. But it turns out that it is more complicated than just that. And so I'm glad today we're having the opportunity to talk a little bit about it. And I think the first thing we should do is really try and define what the issue here is. So, you know, ketotic hypoglycemia is a description of a condition where you have hypoglycemia associated with ketones. And I think we're all familiar as endocrinologists that if we fast anyone for long enough, we can make them both hypoglycemic and ketotic. And so really, when thinking about ketotic hypoglycemia as a pathological entity, I like to think of it in three ways. The first way is just an extreme of normal fasting. So the typical case scenario would be a three-year-old gets gastroenteritis, is at home vomiting with diarrhea, doesn't hold anything down, comes into the emergency room, and maybe they haven't eaten or held anything down for 24 hours, and they're found to have hypoglycemia, and the astute emergency room physician measures the beta hydroxybutyrate and finds it's higher than 2 millimolar and says this is probably what we call just starvation-induced hypoglycemia. And I would say that, you know, 90% of the time they're correct. Mm-hmm. But we also have to remember that ketotic hypoglycemia also refers to hypoglycemia with ketones associated with other conditions. So these conditions, for example, could be the glycogen storage diseases type 0, 3, 6, or 9, or it could be growth hormone deficiency or adrenal insufficiency. It could be some of the severe ketone utilization defects, and it could be some of those really rare conditions that many of us have never seen in our lives, such as genetic defects in MCT1 or NCOR1 or SGLT2. So these are all, these last ones are very, very rare, but present. And then finally, we have what many people would call idiopathic ketotic hypoglycemia, which, as the name implies, is where we don't know the cause. And these are the kids in whom you've eliminated gastroenteritis-induced, starvation-induced hypoglycemia, or these other disorders. And this is a small but rare group of children. And it's very interesting that we're talking about this today, Dr. Steelman, because only this year a whole new patient organization was formed called Ketotic Hypoglycemia International, designed to be a support group for families with ketotic hypoglycemia, you know, specifically don't belong in the bucket of glycogen storage disease where they have their own organization. So It's interesting that we should be talking about this topic right at the time that this organization has been formed. And if any of you have kids out there with severe ketotic hypoglycemia in whom you can't make a diagnosis and they need serious interventions, this is a great resource for your families to meet and discuss with other families. And don't ever hesitate to contact me and I can tell you how to find them. But basically, they're on the World Wide Web at Ketotic Hypoglycemia International. So give them a look if you've got patients with struggling with recurrent hypoglycemia.
Thank you. That's a very good resource. I'm curious. So again, you know, as many pediatricians and emergency room doctors and endocrinologists are going to encounter from time to time ketotic hypoglycemia, what tips or pearls would you offer to help to determine, you know, whether this is potentially just the normal run-of-the-mill benign type of situation we would see versus if this is something more serious that needs more careful investigation or referrals?
So that's a very good point because, you know, when we look at the sort of children who have ketotic hypoglycemia, they typically present outside of the newborn period. So, you know, we know that 1 in 1,400 children coming into the emergency room will have hypoglycemia of unknown etiology. And about 20% of them have a serious underlying cause of the hypoglycemia. And about 70% of the remainder are going to have what we would call just benign, associated with an intercurrent illness, starvation-induced ketotic hypoglycemia. And the key to those children is that the history always can be elicited that they've had some form of very prolonged starvation, be it that they just couldn't eat because of vomiting or a combination of vomiting and diarrhea. So anything they did eat, they didn't absorb. And thus, they'll have this period of time. So the kids you need to be really worried about are the children who come in with hypoglycemia associated with ketones and who have a history that's not consistent with very prolonged starvation. So they maybe woke up in the morning after having a completely normal night the night before. They had a great day. They ate and drank. They were running around like happy little kids. They had their dinner. They went to bed and they woke up in the morning, or rather didn't wake up because they were unresponsive and they were brought into the emergency room. So that is the single most important question we need to ask our parents is, when did the child last eat and have they been vomiting and having diarrhea? And the true ketotic hypoglycemia disorders that need follow-up with endocrinologists or metabolic specialists are those who have very short duration fasting, much shorter than what we'd expect in a normal child.
And you raise a good point. So what would be ballpark normal fasting intervals where you would expect, you know, the glucose control and the, you know, the ability to have appropriate counter-regulatory responses happen, you know, for across the spectrum between infants, children, or teenagers?
Exactly. A very good point. And the reality is that infants, children, and teenagers all have different durations of fasting that we can expect. Mm-hmm. And this is because, you know, the main utilizer of glucose in times of fasting is the brain, and smaller infants have got greater utilization of the brain compared to the rest of their body, so they go through their supplies quicker. And the second issue that small infants and children have is that their livers aren't as big and unable to store as much glycogen as an older person. So we've got those two factors that combine to show that, say, for example, a one-month-old baby typically could fast 15 hours, maybe as long as 18 hours before becoming significantly ketotic and developing low blood sugars, whereas a one-year-old, you'd expect to be able to go 18 hours to 24 hours, mm-hmm. and a five-year-old, you could expect to be able to go 24 to 36 hours, and really, when you get above 10, you should be able to go 48 to 72 hours without eating and maintain your blood sugar in the normal range, and then gradually, as you get out, you know, to the 36 to 48 hours, start breaking down your fat stores and getting your ketone levels up above 2 millimolar. Mm-hmm. So when you see, you know, a one-year-old coming in and they have ketones in their blood after a simple overnight fast that's greater than 0.5 millimolar, then that's accelerated starvation. And you need to think about, do they have one of those problems such as the, you know, the mild glycogen storage diseases, the type 6 or 9, where the kids don't have the big, large bellies with the large livers, but it's a much more subtle abnormality.
Hmm. I see. So what about management? So obviously the management, at least in part, turns on making the proper diagnosis. But is there any tips you offer on management when you have underlying pathology?
Well, you're absolutely correct. Of course, step one in the management is make the correct diagnosis, because by understanding the correct diagnosis, that helps us explain the physiology, and we can therefore implement a treatment for that particular issue. And the treatment is almost always food-based, i.e. one needs to not fast so long as the ketones rise. So the biggest trick I have to recommend to everyone is that this is where, when you bring your child in to do a fasting study, you want to start measuring both your free fatty acids and your ketones early in the fasting study. So as you can see when that inflection point occurs and when your free fatty acids start getting above 0.7 to 1 millimolar and your beta hydroxybutyrate gets above 0.5 to 1 millimolar. At that point in time, you have now used up all your liver glycogen stores if you've been able to get them out. And from here on in, that blood sugar is going to drop really quickly. So by measuring either the free fatty acids or the ketone levels, that will tell you how long the child can safely fast for. And that tells you when you need to do an intervention, such as either giving just a simple bedtime snack so that the patient eats their dinner at 6 o'clock, gets up at 6 or 7 a.m. in the morning, so they're eating 14 hours after dinner. If someone is unable to fast 14 hours, then you have to give them a snack at bedtime. And if they can't even do 8 hours to get overnight from 10 o'clock to 6, you need to give them something in the middle of the night. So that's the real key management issue, is to determine how long it takes the ketones to start to rise above 0.5 to 1 millimolar, and then do an intervention, which is basically feeding either using cornstarch or food or some of the slow-release glucose liquids that we can now make up to prevent prolonged fasting.
I see. That's very interesting. So one of the things, too, it sounds like, is that families need to have proper training on how to check blood sugars at home and also ketones as well, either in the urine or the blood, and be able to do proper intervention.
Yes. I mean, I think really the day of urine ketones for non-diabetics is over. This is where everyone has to have a home blood ketone monitor. And there are a couple of models out in available to families to get for home ketone testing. And although it is a little bit more expensive, we generally recommend that the families check the blood sugars, and only when the blood sugar is drifting downward or the child is reaching the limit of their known safe fasting do they measure a blood ketone. And the purpose of that is to tell them, do I need to go into the hospital at this point, or do I still have a little time to try get some fluids in? Now, this raises another point, which is that should children with the severe forms of idiopathic ketotic hypoglycemia who are unable to fast overnight, should they have a G button in? And this is something that one should give careful consideration to, because the placement of a G button allows a family to hook up a dextrose solution that could be made with simple table sugar at home, are using a medical grade sugar like Polycose or Solcarb, then using these tools, families know that if the child won't eat, they can hook them up, give them some sugar through the G button, and thus prevent the need for a hospitalization. So that's a very careful consideration that you have to give. And I have to say that the children who are really unable to go longer than 8 hours of fasting, almost all of them, in my opinion, deserve a G button to try and prevent emergency hospitalizations.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything that we can do to try to empower the families and give them the tools to manage their child at home, I think is an important step for them.
Yes. Staying out of the hospital is probably the best possible thing you can do.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. That was very interesting and very enlightening on ketotic hypoglycemia. We're going to take another break, and when we return, Dr. Thornton and I are going to discuss dumping syndrome.
You're listening to Pastola Endocrine Podcast. For more information about Pastola and upcoming events, please visit pastola.org.
Problems for these children is that because they have so many episodes of hypoglycemia that they essentially develop hypoglycemic unawareness. Now, I know, Dr. Steelman, you're going to say to me, yes, but Paul, you just told us it was infants and babies, and we all know that they don't express the symptoms of hypoglycemia. But sometimes these Nissen fundoplications are done in older children for different reasons, and they sometimes initially might be able to detect the hypoglycemia, but very quickly that ability goes away. And so these children have asymptomatic severe hypoglycemia due to hypoglycemic unawareness. Now, the other thing that's very interesting is that we've talked about, you know, this happening from G buttons and Nissen fundoplications. And typically, if you do a Nissen fundoplication with a G button, the incidence of dumping is about 25%, which is a very high number. And really, every parent who's having that procedure should be told there's a 1 in 4 chance that they will develop a hypoglycemic disorder afterwards, and it should be screened for. But what people sometimes forget is that probably about 1% of children who have a G button placed without a Nissen fundoplication will have dumping. And that other conditions such as repair of diaphragmatic hernias or the repair of tracheoesophageal fistulas has also been associated with dumping, through mechanisms that we don't quite understand. So there are sometimes some very subtle other causes that one needs to think about.
So that is very interesting. I mean, that seems like it's something that really, you know, I would say probably, you know, people in the pediatric realm need to think about, but certainly as endocrinologists we do. So how do we go about that, besides simply having an index of suspicion for risk for dumping syndrome, hypoglycemia, how do we go about making the diagnosis? Because that can be certainly from my personal experience, a challenge at times.
Well, you've just asked me my favorite question. So that gives me the chance to give you my favorite answer.
Go
and
ahead.
The answer is that when you're concerned about the possibility of dumping, the best way to make the diagnosis is to take the baby's shirt off. Because if you take the baby's shirt off and there's a big old G button, then the number 1 to 10 differential diagnosis is that this is dumping. If there's no G button but a big old scar, then you're thinking, this baby had some gastrointestinal surgery. So again, when you see that, that's the key to the diagnosis. However, I bet you're asking me something a little more pragmatic, like what way do you do the critical sample? And that is a very interesting point. Because the critical sample in dumping looks exactly like hyperinsulinism. So you take a blood test when the blood sugar is low, you'll find probably elevated insulin levels. You'll find for sure low free fatty acids and beta hydroxybutyrate. And so dumping is basically a hyperinsulinemic condition. So how do you differentiate it from all the other hyperinsulinemic conditions? And that is the key. And of course, the way to do that is our favorite test, which is to put the patient on a continuous tube feed, because almost always they have a tube in place, and then you slowly ramp down the feeding at the end of a period of 6 or 12 hours, and you cut it by, I typically do a third, a third, a third every 20 minutes, so that you get a gentle weaning of the tube feeding, and then you monitor the blood sugars, and what you'll see is that compared to a normal day where the baby or the infant or young child is having hypoglycemia before the next meal, they're suddenly able to fast 6, 9, 12 hours without hypoglycemia, and that's the key. So the key in briefly is that when hypoglycemia occurs preprandially after a tube feed but does not occur when you do a slow ramp down of a continuous feed without a bolus, that's how you make the diagnosis of dumping.
Great. Well, thank you. That's actually very enlightening. And I think, you know, it's certainly something that we think about, but it may not be something that would be readily obvious to people outside of like the endocrine field. Now, I could throw you a softball here and say, Dr. Thornton, how do we treat dumping with hypoglycemia? And you would say, we avoid doing bolus feedings. But I'm going to ask you, so if you have a family that really wants, they're like, they don't want their child tethered to continuous feeding, what are the options that are available for that family rather than having their child tethered to continuous feedings?
Right. Well, I hate to tell you, but there aren't very many options at all. So,
okay.
For example, diazoxide has been tried and it does not work. Octreotide has been tried and it does not work. For those people who are at the recent Endocrine Society meeting, you might have heard a study using Xeris glucagon. So Xeris makes a form of glucagon that's liquid stable and can be put into pumps. And so people have tried using that by giving a small bolus either by injection after the meal or by hooking up to an insulin pump and infusing it for a couple of hours after the meal. And of course, that's an off-label use of glucagon and an off-label use of an insulin pump. But there are things that are being tried. You know, from an investigative stuff, people are trying some of the GLP-1 inhibitors. So as if you can block the GLP-1 receptor, then you lose the GLP-1 effect. So people are trying those things. But the reality is that the only way you can treat dumping is not to give a bolus liquid feed. So the quicker you can get the patient onto oral solid food, the better. So typically what I would recommend is that you put the patient on a continuous tube feed overnight when everybody's sleeping, and you continue, the blood sugar is maintained very well with continuous feeds, And then during the day, they practice eating solid food. And you only give them solids by mouth. You don't give them liquids that contain sugar. And as a general rule, that can fix it. Now, interestingly enough, there have been case reports of using a ketogenic diet to treat patients with dumping. And so, again, this would be sort of an off-label use of a ketogenic diet. But if you can give a patient a formula that's carbohydrate-free, such as Ross carbohydrate-free formula, and then replace the sugar from the carbohydrate-free formula with something that's extremely slowly absorbed, and they're getting primarily protein and fat in their diet, then actually the blood sugars will run in the low 50s and high 60s, but the beta-hydroxybutyrate will run in the 2 millimolar, and so they end up being able to manage that way. But that is not a palatable diet for babies, and most families would not go down that pathway and would choose the feeding for 12 hours at night and fasting during the day, but just eating solid food and not taking any liquids. And interestingly, when you do that, you very quickly teach them how to eat solid food, and very quickly you're able to lower the nighttime feed as they eat more solid food during the day and eventually get them off the tube feeds, which is where you need to be to resolve the problem.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. This has been very enlightening. Before we go, do you have any final thoughts or things that you would like to offer the audience as far as hypoglycemia investigation or other pearls?
Yes. Well, firstly, let me thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with everyone out there. And let me remind you all that please feel free, if you ever have any difficult cases, to give me a call or to send me an email at myfirstname.lastname@cookchildrens.org. But let me remind you of some of the key principles. The key principles are to think about the timing of the hypoglycemia relative to when the patient last fasted, last ate. And so that tells you if this is short duration hypoglycemia, that it's occurring within, 0 to 4 hours, if it's happening in the, 4 to 12 hours or greater than 12 hours. And using that that timing, you think about the normal patterns of fasting adaptation. And by thinking about those things in your head and seeing how long ago did my patient last eat, that really tells you what area of physiology you have to focus on. And that's the key to then guiding your testing. What are the tests I need to do? And the key then is to get the correct diagnosis. So again, the one simple thing to remember is, when did this patient last eat relative to the hypoglycemia? And obviously, if it happens to a patient on an intravenous glucose infusion, then you've really narrowed that down to a very few things where you get hypoglycemic while having a glucose infusion in place. And of course, that's my favorite disease, hyperinsulin.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, and this has been very informative. The audience, thank you again for listening, and we hope that you'll join us for the next episode. Please visit our website at pestola.org or follow us on social media as we announce a release of upcoming podcast. Thank you again, Dr. Thornton.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Stillman.